like your reviews were much more verbose versions of my reviews.
Well, Brian, you're never going to write a verbose review. Right.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome to the Mediocre Movie Cast, Deadwood Edition, in which we go through a series rewind of one of the greatest TV shows ever made. I'm insane fucking person John Kissel, and with me tonight to discuss these two episodes is lying, blackmailing sack of shit Shane Centner.
Yo.
And a grotesque of inconceivable stupidity, Brian Hartman.
Hey!
What's up?
Shane and I are Deadwood repeat viewers, and our hearts fucking leap with joy while Brian is our Deadwood rookie. Though he has a digest from which he memorizes. In this episode, we'll be discussing episodes 3 and 4 of Deadwood's third season, entitled True Colors and Full Faith and Credit. These two episodes kind of continue the Deadwood tradition of the third and fourth episodes of the season being a little down. That was kind of the case last season, kind of the case in the first season. I think it's very much the case in these two episodes. There's certainly, it is Deadwood, a lot of great stuff in here. But it doesn't seem as unified, and what is great doesn't really rise to the level of like the level that we've been expecting. Would you guys agree with that?
No, I feel like we differ on the greatness of every episode.
Well, sure, but there are levels within levels.
Right, but like everyone that you're in love with, like the end of last season you loved, and I was just like, oh, it's good, and then I feel like these were good episodes.
Yeah, I'm with Brian on this one. I love these two episodes. I've laughed more at these episodes than I have in a while.
Yeah,
these are two funny episodes. I think you're right. It maybe wasn't so cohesive, especially to the larger point. There's a lot going on, and maybe kind of the second of these two episodes with Bullock is almost like a one-off, kind of like the Miles and whatever story.
Yeah, Miles and Flora.
Yeah, that's right. So,
they like to introduce new characters at this point in the season. Like, we got the Bella Union people in the first season, and then we got Walcott showing up in the second season, and now we have Aunt Lou and Langrish and his troop showing up in this season. And so you just got to spend some time, you got to spend a lot of time with new characters as opposed to the characters that you've grown to love.
Yeah.
And with those two characters in particular, Aunt Lou and Langrish, I mean, they're off to a great start as far as merging in with the crew. We'll start with Langrish, who shows up to camp, and he's immediately got this fantastic rapport with Al. And you see that they're old friends from somewhere way back. And that just their back and forth is spot on, like Al, the misanthrope, versus Langrish, who tips his hat at everybody, getting a tour of the camp. Just a completely different person. And perhaps in their differences, they're just able to really mesh and click really well. As Paul Abdul said, of course, opposites attract.
Brian, what'd you think of Langrish?
I don't know. It's kind of indifferent. I was hoping we'd get to see a play. Don't ruin anything. But
I mean, they just got there.
I know. Maybe a musical, because the MMC hates musicals except for me. So I'd be down with that.
The theater troupe that showed up with Langrish, did they make any impression on you guys? They're the two women, primarily two women, yes, and there's a third woman that is also in camp that showed up with them, but her relationship is pretty murky at this point.
I feel like the wife of Langrish is almost the character building for him even now.
Wait. One of those women is his wife?
Which one?
Yes.
Wait, he has multiple wives? What?
No. There's two women. There's an older European one.
That's his wife, right?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay, here we get into the most controversial plot point critically in Deadwood history. Like, these characters never really pop, and we're going to spend a good amount of time with them.
What do you mean they don't pop?
Like, I don't have a good sense of who they are. not only like who they are internally, but like who they are in relationship to Langrish or the other people.
I assume they're just hired actresses.
Yes. But I mean, Shane's seen this series several times before and you think they're married.
I thought they were married or some sort of serious relationship. I mean, like all the comments to her from her to him about getting some, and then her, I mean, going out and fucking the most grotesque person in camp.
Right, yeah, across, I mean, the hall. The Chinese shrunk his pants. I mean, yeah. Nothing he can do about it.
I mean, right across the hall from his room. It was intentional. Yeah,
I definitely think that was intentional, but just even with as many times as I've seen the series, what she's trying to prove in that moment is really cloudy.
I thought it was always making him jealous. Like, that's,
I feel like I just totally whiffed on this whole scene. Like, I don't even know what you two are talking about.
Claudia sleeping with Khan or flirting with Khan. He's adjusting his boner while he's trying to teach her how to play craps.
Oh, yeah. She's got the huge boobs, right?
Yeah, he keeps laughing and squeaking.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then they're in bed, and he's like, Leon, when you left, unprovoked, I must say, said, hey, would you look at that set?
I thought you said something
about... Yeah,
he needs
a couple of days of refractory period, and then he'll be good to go.
Well, maybe in 3 days.
I thought you said the Chinese...
The Chinese shrunk his pants. That's why his dick is showing through them.
Oh, see, I thought you meant that she slept with a Chinese guy. Oh, no. Man. All right, I'm totally whiffed on that one.
Fantastic.
I do know what you're talking about now, though. I'm with you.
All right, third guy.
So, yeah, that'll be something we keep an eye on in these last 8 episodes, if we can figure out exactly what's going on with the theater people. Because I confess to being... still confused at this date.
Let's just throw this out there. If anyone understands theater people in general to this day, it's a small miracle.
All right, fair enough. I think that'll get us some comments at least. We'll have somebody, one of our many, many listeners will listen to this episode.
I mean, UE had an incredible theater program.
That's the University of Evansville for our non-UE listeners.
Fighting Purple Aces.
Fighting's a strong word, but go ahead.
And my sister-in-law does Traveling Beauty and the Beast for the last 2 years. And just theater people. I mean, she's great. But if you put them all together, there's something else.
They're weird.
Yeah.
They're the people who all got really upset legitimately about David Bowie dying. Like, all of them. There's not one theater person who's like, Bowie sucked.
He's just off in space.
Bowie.
Playing in a band, space. I presume.
Yeah. So, This brings back a memory of, gosh, you guys were doing a podcast about one of the movies and you wanted to do a poll like of something, like, I don't know. You should do those on Twitter. Like, so this one we could have our David Bowie poll.
Are you sad about David Bowie dying?
Yes.
Like everyone
else. And your choices would be yes or I have no idea what you're talking about and I would vote for the second.
It just sailed right over your head.
You're not even allowed to say no, too, because then you're part of the man.
I'm not sure I knew he was dead outside of listening to a Malcolm Gladwell podcast. Mm-hmm. So,
speaking of his podcast today, this week's Revisionist History, not very good.
Which one are you talking about? The religion one?
No, the something about satire. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, yeah, where he's really upset about Saturday Night Live not being as poignant as
is
British.
That-
Right. It was okay.
I thought you were going to say, like, Madison Saturday Live not being as good as it used to be.
It was
one of those old arguments.
No,
okay. Sorry.
He's saying that they basically assassinated their own, like, relevance as satire, political satire, when they invited Sarah Palin on there. Which I don't necessarily disagree with that.
Repulsive politicians on
they
in
have.
Their 30 year history.
He was just
prior
saying
to
that.
That
satire, if done improperly, is worthless or something like that.
Yeah, like the Great Dictator,
because
for example.
It has to be, like, satire would have to be, it'd have to influence people and change people's minds. And, like, Stephen Colbert doesn't. But then again, he gave this example of some Israeli satire that I'm sure doesn't change anyone's minds either. So,
right.
It was not his best episode.
It wasn't. But the prior one, the one about religion, that was fantastic.
That was a great episode.
That was like top 10 podcast of all time, in my opinion.
Might have to check it out.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do podcasts about podcasts. How meta
really, really dig down the rabbit hole, kicking out meta podcasts like a badger. To quote our next character, Aunt Lou, who's new to the episode, she is Hearst's longtime servant, cook, housemaid, jack of all trades, I would imagine. He just does everything for him. And we're introduced to her coming off of the stagecoach from the top, of course. I doubt she would have been allowed inside the stagecoach. She had to sit up top with a newly fancy woo as the stagecoach comes into Deadwood. And Hearst just runs out like a literal boy that the earth talks to. He gives her a big hug, and then they're inside, and she's pulling his boots off. And he defers to her initially in their interactions, and it's a very peculiar relationship. It makes him very childlike, as I said, and that's the way he likes it. He likes things in a very specific manner. He likes things prepared for him in a very specific way, and the person that's been with him for a very long time knows exactly how to do that. And he doesn't give a shit that people see him being nice and friendly to a black person, even though she is full of resentment towards Hearst, as we see in her last scene in episode 3, in the third episode.
Yeah, her playing, I don't know what she's playing.
Mahjong, maybe?
Mahjong. That would be my stereotypical guess.
Mine as well.
But, like, I was, like, okay with her as a character, and then she quickly shot up the charts of favorite characters when I saw that scene.
Yeah, that's a great scene. To add another person of color to the series and then had her just be, like, a normal-ass servant would have been pretty disappointing. And we're not let down.
No. And I think even with her back and forth with Hearst, he's not just asking for like a bootlick, someone who just agrees with everything he says. I do think she's allowed to be intelligent in her scenes with Hearst, while keeping her true colors hidden, to be let out in front of Richardson and the Chinese who probably can barely understand her in the first place. Like, she has the line about the bird singing sweeter in Missouri or wherever. But then once Hearst says that this is the richest find he's ever seen, her line about, I guess they can keep those birds then. She's just really drilled into Hearst's personality and what he wants. Like, no matter, like, they were just being all nostalgic about their former environment. But there's a whole shit ton of gold here. So who gives a fuck about the birds and whatever else, and Hearst's family, and it's all about the gold for Hearst,
and she's not remotely threatening to him.
Also true. Yeah. Also true.
So, and I think that because I think one of the good parts of the Hearst character is he shows up. He seems pretty inoffensive, you know, initially, but then I mean he'll quickly turn it on once he realizes, sums up the room, says, "All right, you're in my way. You're in my way. You're in my way."
Yeah.
Or you can help me get something done. I'm going to use you. So with her, she's none of those things. He's already summed her up long ago. So he can actually just be nice to her.
Yeah. And we also get from Aunt Lou.
Hold on. We're talking about Hearst real fast. He was in a preview of something I saw, and he plays a doctor.
Hearst.
And yeah, Hearst. Whoever Hearst is the actor. I've never seen him before.
Gerald McRaney is his name.
Okay, there you go. He's
in Major Dad.
Perfect. He's in something new, and he plays the doctor. And
you know, that does sound familiar.
And I know you like him, so there we go.
I love him in this role. I think he's a fantastic villain.
Are you talking about 1981 Simon and Simon?
Did you guys ever watch the greatest television show ever on Adult Swim? It was just Adam Scott and a rotating cast of characters recreating 80s TV series opening credits.
Oh,
fantastic.
I would watch that.
That was one of them. Like, they did Simon and Simon with Adam Scott and John Hamm. John Hamm in the show died during production from exposure. I hate to blow it, but oh man, that's just, that's a great, a great little four-part series. The greatest television show ever made.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
It's a show on Adult Swim. Anyways, the last thing to say about Aunt Lou, like, we get a peek into why Hearst, like, what Hearst is after, and it's not cash, it's not additional comfort. He doesn't give a shit about those. It's just more. He just likes telling people how much he's worth. He likes people knowing that, especially people like Aunt Lou, who he just loves the look of astonishment on their face when he blurts out that number. He gets increasingly despicable as the season goes on, and he started pretty despicable in the first place. But anyways, I mentioned people returning to camp, like Mr. Wu and Blazanov. The most dramatic return to camp is Hostetler and the General. They return with the murder horse. And this...
the murder horse.
Yeah, the murder
nice.
Horse.
Nice. I know, that's just creative.
we'll wait for Steven Spielberg to adapt it. We're not going to hold our breath or anything.
That would be a good movie title.
The Murder Horse. Yeah. I'm sure there's like some bargain basement in a gas station somewhere that has that exact movie in there. I mean, if Ghost Coach can have 7 sequels, then I don't understand why Murder Horse couldn't have at least 4.
I'm sure Cooker would pick it for our...
yeah, he probably would.
Our actual movie club.
It may very well already be on our spreadsheet.
I feel like we've had the same exact conversation before with a different set of words.
It's entirely possible.
Or I mean, if we're going to say Murder Horse is a band, we'd be like, I'm sure Phil listens to him.
A lot of, yeah, easy listening types.
Yeah.
They sing about rain a lot. Old Murder Horse.
No one listens to us anymore, so we can pretty much say whatever we want.
That is true. It's basically,
that's
just
so different from when we were strictly censoring ourselves.
Slightly above average fan Dave, the only one who listens to us. And he's never even seen the show.
Oh, good.
Anyways, Hostetler and the General's return is not taken too well by Steve, who's going to be our character focus this week. He predicts a bad result and then forces it to happen. Although we leave this episode with him possibly... we lost him.
It's all right. We'll just keep talking.
Sorry, I was closing apps on my phone because I got distracted by IMDb and I hit the wrong one.
Were you looking up Gerald McCraney as well?
Yeah.
Yeah,
a lot of TV stuff. Castle? I stopped looking.
I don't even know.
Now dude's got like 135 credits. 135 credits.
Never ending story. That's coming back out. Maybe that's it.
I did see when I was digging through there, I saw Richardson. Richardson in real life looks just like Richardson in Deadwood.
I doubt his IMDb page is too long.
He's struggling.
He's also sadly departed.
Yes. Oh. He's definitely struggling to find new roles at this point.
He can star in a movie with Eazy-E's skeleton from our last podcast.
Wow.
It'll be Richardson skeleton and Eazy-E's skeleton in a buddy comedy. They'll travel the country, Route 66.
One's an inner city black man. The other one's a yokel from the west,
curled out of some bog somewhere. Okay, Steve's angry. Bullock wants to play peacemaker. This is kind of a farce.
A
very racist farce. That we get between these three. Hostetler just wants to leave, sell the livery to Steve, who's been taking care of it, settle their business there and move on with the General. Steve just makes it as difficult as possible.
I haven't had a good Bullock complaint in a while.
Okay.
So I've got one
on
here.
On purpose or because you've just run out of things to say negative about him?
How do you possibly complain about Bullock in these episodes?
No, I think he's great. I think he's absolutely great. I think they're letting Tim off the leash in these episodes. But go ahead, Brian.
So I think he does a great job negotiating between these two. Like, I was enthralled. I wanted to see what was going to happen. However, at one point, I don't even know if it was related to this, he like walks into his hardware store super fast, like he's going to go 100 yards deep into the hardware store until he gets caught by...
Do you mean the scene where Steve first comes into the hardware store and tells them that the general is back in Hostetler?
I don't know.
Because he, like, looms over him. He, like, takes huge steps towards Steve and, like, looms over him.
No. He comes, like, marching in like he's going to go somewhere that's 100 yards away. And then he's caught what's his partner's name?
Saul.
Saul. He's caught by Saul. And he stops. And it's just awkward with his walk like he's going somewhere. So that was my big
Was this in the thick of the negotiations?
Probably. Like, I don't know.
Physically frustrated?
My notes say, Seth walks into hardware store speedily. Where is he going?
Fantastic. Okay, but I mean, this plot line is a big hit for you, it sounds like, Brian.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Okay, fantastic. Steve. Goddamn Steve.
Steve.
We'll talk more about Steve a little later. Good to see Hostetler in the general back. They are another duo that just plays off each other very well. Franklin Ajay playing the general, and I don't know who plays Hostetler off the top of my head. But yeah, we'll continue that next week. We got the first half. We're going to get more in the next couple episodes. Back on the Hearst front, he's had another organizer killed in the third episode, another Cornish organizer. Framed it as an accident. His guards say it was an accident, just a mining accident, as will happen. And Bullock confronts Hearst about it to no effect. I think Hearst wisely calls Bullock on his complete ignoring of the two Hearst guards that were murdered in the gym 10 days prior. And Bullock, this is a conflicting scene for me because Hearst is so obviously killing organizers and fuck his guards for riling up the organizer they killed in the season opener. But at the same time, yeah, Bullock doesn't get to act all righteous about this murder and ignore those other two murders. So Hearst totally gets it. He's just totally outmaneuvered him. There's nothing Bullock can do about it. Bullock puts Hearst on notice, but that doesn't mean anything. That means literally nothing. Hearst is just too powerful for these guys. He mutilated Al in episode 2, and now he's totally marginalized Bullock by episode 3. Bullock just wants to set the law aside and go after him, but Al counsels patience. It's just too early for that shit. So we're going to put that off into the future as well. Justifiably, Bullock would that would go badly if Bullock was able to indulge his angry emotions. So, yeah. Anything to add about Bullock and Hearst?
I don't have a single note on those two. All
right, good stuff. So I mentioned Al and his interaction with Hearst, and he spends these two episodes grappling with having been so totally owned and emasculated by him. He spent the 10 days in between episode 3 and 2 more or less just hiding in the gym. Trixie gets him a little motivated at the start of this episode, and Langreish gets him out and about in the town. But then he's more or less back to square one in the fourth episode, having junk problems, unable to get it up with Dolly anymore, which culminates in two more blowjob monologues, and we get to learn more about Al's past. Although this one seems a little more vague, like maybe Al is remembering incorrectly, the story doesn't track as well. What did you guys think of that closing blowjob monologue that Al had in episode 4?
Was this the one about
holding him down?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Because as he told that story in the first season, his mother dropped him off at the orphanage and ran away, and that was that. In this telling, he chased after her while being restrained by the orphanage people. Both of those things could be true. And I'm allowing some extra textual information from the Deadwood book, click on the Amazon.com link on bnickmovie.club and go to Amazon and buy the Deadwood book.
Yes.
Where Milch talks a little bit about the unreliable narration in this scene. Like Al, something terrible happened to Al in the present, and he's mixing it with terrible things that happened to him in his past. And the specifics matter less than the emotion.
Right.
Where, like, the emotion of Al being held down probably tracks a lot with instances in his past where he was held down. We know how terrible we have a sense of how terrible the orphanage was for women and for boys, or for girls and for boys as well. So pretty dark shit. And it allows him a moment of empathy with Dolly too, and a pretty beautiful cap to the episode.
Yeah. I've always been more focused on the emotion of it as well.
Yeah.
And like the things he's saying, or the things he's not really saying, but are coming through with that story. So, especially by him being completely emasculated and feeling powerless. I'm sure if, like, when I feel that way, I tend to have dreams.
Okay.
Where I'm trying to shoot a basketball, but I can't.
Mm.
That's when I'm like feeling like out of control of my life, or like I'm driving a car and I can't hit the brakes; it just keeps going.
Those dreams take the form for me in being in Vegas, but I can't find the table.
Ugh.
Like somebody's like keeping me in the hotel room. I can't find the cab from the airport. Something's keeping me from the tables.
That's torture.
It really is. I wake up exhausted and really wanting to gamble. So it's.
I don't have a clue what you guys are talking about.
Do you have any dreams like when you're feeling out of control? Like any specific like recurring dreams? Or do you
no.
have you're just dead in Illinois.
It's just
dead.
Zeros and ones.
I just
in loop. And when he's having a nightmare there's a two.
I was trying to explain this to my students today that like my short term memory.
What is this Q-mon emotion?
Trying to like remember anything from a prior day is just not happening. I have no idea. I slept in Jane's bed last night because she was having a bad dream, but that's about it.
Okay.
That's all I got for you.
I'll be able to like lucid dream sometimes.
I've never been able to do that.
But when
I understand that it's something you can train yourself to do.
It's pretty awesome.
Okay.
It is pretty awesome. But like not when I'm having these dreams, I can't do it. Especially the basketball one where I'm like, come on, just shoot it. Shoot the dang ball.
Can you use your arms?
No, I can't move at all. It's a problem.
You gotta like seal it into
it
the
used to be I couldn't
basket.
See when I was doing it, and now it's like I can see, but I can't move my arms.
Hey,
I've also started mixing some baseball ones in, like, but I can never find my equipment.
Those are my true nightmares when I'm playing baseball.
For you, I figured that would be like your good dreams, as you can't find the equipment. You're just like, dash it, I'm done. I don't have to play.
Speaking of baseball, how is team au revoir, Shoshana?
We were losing earlier.
We're winning. We're winning this week. Five games up in second place.
Question about dreams while we're on this awesome tangent.
Brian, get out of my brain, changing the subject here. I was
do,
hoping a sweet segue, but I don't have
do,
to.
This would also be a good Twitter poll. Do you dream in third person or first person?
Why would that be a good Twitter poll? What does that have to do with them? Why would that
it's just a great thing? Question.
Just a general just, question.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no idea.
Mine's
I
generally
think first.
Yeah, mine's generally in first, especially the lucid dreaming is obviously in first. But there's also flashes of like – in third person.
See, I've never had a third person dream where I can like see the back of my head or myself. It's always first person.
I mean, you have like a dozen dreams every night and you only remember the last one. Maybe.
Whatever. My entire life of 32-ish years, no third person dreams that I can remember.
Interesting.
I know, right?
You
That's
know who's
it's
probably
a good
having
question.
No dreams because she's high as fuck is Alma.
Or
because,
maybe having really good dreams. I don't know.
I think when you're just bombed like that, you just kind of pass out until you wake up.
I wouldn't know
anything about that.
Or she could be just whatever's going on in reality is the best dream at this point.
Potentially true. After her brat, brat, pow, pow, she's up and at 'em. She is a dynamo, as Hearst calls her. She's opening a bank. She's working at the bank. And she's also making proposals to Hurst about becoming partners, him becoming a minority owner in her stake in exchange for ownership in his stakes. This does not go over well with sociopath Hurst, who is not good at dealing with people. He's like a proto Daniel Plainview. There's a lot of Daniel Plainview in Hurst, but here nor there. I'm sure we'll get to a character focus for him one day. He violently rejects this and intimidates her to the point where she is running through the thoroughfare, terrified, and justly so because he is terrifying in that moment. This only puts more distance in her marriage with Ellsworth, as he wants to protect her from that, and he does a little bit of, not a little bit, he does, he victim blames in this scenario. She was right to be intimidated. She would have deserved whatever happened to her. So things aren't going very well in the Ellsworth household. And we end with Alma in the fourth episode of her looking back at her family in a happy moment. Her loveless husband playing checkers with her much-loved adopted daughter. But Leon's in the window. What could he possibly be selling her? And she chooses to go after Leon. So she's back on it in a big way. Again, I've mentioned before, anything with drugs or intoxicants in general, I defer to the show for being true. Because David Milch knows all about this shit. So just how easy it is to revert back to using. I think the storyline depressingly gets at that very well. Any thoughts on Alma this week, guys? Her travails?
Her interaction with Hurst made me kind of sad, but that's it.
No, she... Sorry. Yeah, more.
No, but I can add more.
No, I thought you didn't. I thought you went, I thought we were going to get a little bit more, but I guess not.
I have a note here that I think Ellsworth has PTSD from whatever he's got going on.
Oh, he 100%. Is, clawing at his skin while he's in the room with Hurst. And he very well might, like, he essentially is like a 9/11 first responder, where he's like digging people out of wreckage.
Right.
Minus the cancer. So, yeah, I'm sure that was a very difficult experience for him, pulling dead people out of a mine and being unimpressed with the alive people that he pulled out, as he talked about back in the second season in his confrontation with Walcott. He just can't be in the same room as Hurst, and he knows who he is. He has a clear sense of who he is. And Hurst isn't disabusing us of those accusations either. He clearly is that person, as much as he tries to be courteous and has his Aunt Lou in town now. And the series is great. Episode 3 is just packed with characters interacting with Hurst that we hadn't seen previously interacting with Hurst. And again, he's such a great character, such a great realization of the 19th century Gilded Age type robber barons who just don't have a good sense of the world outside of exactly what they want.
Let's say with Alma, she does seem a little erratic because, like I said, it doesn't really confirm it to the end of the episode, but that she is on drugs. And just see her kind of act a little bit out of character from what she's used to. She's usually a little more reserved. And I think it's the combination of the drugs and the fact that she does have power now, whereas she's on drugs before, but she's completely submissive. And she doesn't want that. So she's acting out a little differently enough to, I think, take notice.
Yeah, I like Alma used to have to use drugs to get to a place where she could please the men around her, whether it was her father and then Brom Garrett. And she doesn't have to please men anymore. So I'm forming this as I'm speaking it, so it may not be all the way there. But I don't know, like, maybe she's flipping that arrangement now. Like, she wants the world to adapt to her while leaving laudanum as part of the arrangement. If I can be high and powerful at the same time, let's try that out. That sounds pretty fucking great. The world's just not bending to what she wants. As powerful as she is still vulnerable, very vulnerable in this society. And as much as she wants Hirsch to treat her as an equal, not only would he not treat anyone as an equal, there is no scenario where he would partner up with a woman, I don't think.
It's reckless thinking.
Yes, reckless. Yeah, him with the unbuttoned shirt, him leaning in for a sniff after as she's leaving. He's just despicable.
100%.
Yeah. A couple stray observations, plot threads before we move on. Doc is rumored to be a lunger. Brian, what do you think about that?
Oh, I've got tons of stray notes on this one.
All right.
On everything in general.
Okay.
I had this like as soon as the episode started before they really brought it up. A doc is going to die of this cough. Where's the next doctor? Like I feel like
you're already thinking of replacements for our beloved Doc Cochran.
So I think they've done an awesome job of foreshadowing this. Like we've known he's always had this cough in the background since as long as I can remember him being around.
Sorry to disappoint you and give you a little spoiler, but Doc does die and is replaced by Doogie Howser, which is exactly why this series got canceled. Milch just, he messed up. He messed up on that.
It's not even Neil Patrick Harris. It's literally Doogie Howser.
Sweet.
He brings his Italian buddy with him. It doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
He's got like modern tools and practices. So it's disappointing is what it is. Other stray thread is that Langrish is trying to buy the Shezami from Joni for use as his theater, and she is grappling with the potential severing of her relationship with the school, with the children. And that's been a hugely rejuvenative thing for her. And we also learned in this episode, in episode 4, that the first day of school was the first episode of the season. That wasn't quite clear in the season premiere, I don't think, but those are the stakes for this season. Like those kids in that school, or those kids in a school. Like that, it's just a beautiful thing when a society can decide to educate its children instead of putting the children down the mine, as is certainly happening in the country at this time and will for many years after. So it's a very optimistic. It's fundamentally optimistic. Like this town is going to hold. This future is going to work. And at the same time, that's happening. Someone like Hirsch is tearing walls down and venturing out onto roofs and potentially destroying the camp and the children and the school and all that goes with it. So those are the two poles of the season. And Joni is justifiably concerned that one of those is going to go away. What other notes you got, Brian?
I got just points and notes. One, I have that Richardson and EB are starting to look very similar. Just
EB's letting his hair down. I think
they're just totally disheveled, just all over the place. I have a question.
Go for it.
Has anyone done a movie on the bloodiness of the labor movement? I feel like this is American history that is often glossed over. It is one of our bloodiest times and would make for some great movies.
I can't, from this time period, I can't think of anything. Like there's labor movies from the 80s and the 70s, like Norma Rae and Silkwood.
But as far as
like stuff like the Haymarket Riot in Chicago and just general 19th century unionizing, I honestly can't think of anything.
I mean, I'm thinking like 19th century all the way up through, you know, the 1920s and 30s.
Sure.
When unions finally get a little bit of power. But that would there's just great movies to be made there.
It's too fucking depressing.
Yeah, they didn't win.
Right, but that can still make for a great movie. That's almost like the greatest of movies.
Yeah. I mean, I would certainly love to see that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's undertold, no question.
Yes.
I mean, back in our greatness.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's Reds, which is like a 3-hour epic Warren Beatty movie from the early 80s. But that's not about like unions specifically. There are unions in the background like Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party in America and Warren Beatty's character going back and forth between the Russian Revolution and America trying to, trying to replicate it in America.
Right, because I'm as pacifist as it gets, but we have a handgun in our safe.
Really?
But it is, my uncle gave it to me, so my grandfather gave it to my uncle, and my great-grandfather gave it to my grandpa. He used it when he worked on the railroad when they were doing union busting. Like, he had it for protection.
Hmm.
And that's just, even my grandfather is super, super liberal. And so you've got liberal, 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 but four generations back, my grandfather had a gun to keep himself safe from being killed working on the railroad.
There is a great documentary from the 70s called Harlan County, USA, about miners in Kentucky fighting Duke Energy. And it's brutal, shockingly brutal for the 1970s. Not the content, but just that this stuff is happening in the 1970s.
Okay.
Where you have like violent union busting happening again in the 70s.
Right. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. I didn't cover any of this in my labor law class that was taught by the labor attorney who worked for companies.
There.
It's a different
age.
Tell
me how everything actually works. Kind of like, I imagine if I taught a workers' compensation class, it'd be a lot different than the one the defense attorney would teach. Like, the system works every time when someone's actually hurt. Okay?
I think the defense attorney would use the word freeloader a lot more often.
Yeah.
It's just taken for granted in the show that organizers and high graders, well, high graders, okay, fine, they're fraudsters. But, like, organizers are said in the same word as that. It's just a uniform bad for this era. Because everybody in this town, or, like, a good chunk of them at least, used to own a mine. And the idea of them having to pay their workers more, that wouldn't exactly jive with them either. There's a really interesting, like, anti-collective sentiment from Hearst on down. I would imagine everybody feels the more or less the same way. So
right.
Just these Cornish organizers are fighting against the tide. And that's a mind-bogglingly brave thing to do.
Right. I mean, I would watch a movie about the Cornish. I know nothing about them until this show. So this would be great. I got my physical therapy wife, Chelsea, uses the word ambulated.
Hey, I took a note about that. Mary got his ambulators group up. They just meet at night, and it's him and Blazanov.
Yeah, and so she was recording notes verbally on her iPad for work, and she says her patient's ambulated. And I was like, oh, that's great. I love that word. So
I'm sure they have a secret handshake and everything.
Yeah.
140 years of history.
I have two questions here that maybe you can clear up for me. Somebody stole some money from the bank. Is that important?
What are you talking about?
Like, in the background, somebody ran off with some cash from the bank.
Oh, no, he was going to put cash in and then saw the fight and left.
I thought he took off with some money. Maybe I was wrong.
I think these people have a very strong radar for when things are potentially going to kick off. And when the Hoople, who is skeptical of banking in general, starts to raise his voice, that's just a sign for people to leave. I think that's all that was.
All right, I'll have to watch it again to make sure. And my last question is, why is Hawkeye gone and he can't be mentioned? Like, what's going on with him? Where'd he go?
He's out fucking in Indian somewhere. That's his M.O. He mentioned that very offhandedly in one episode. I don't know. I don't have a good sense of why Al doesn't like him exactly. Dan beat the shit out of him at the start of season two. And anyone Dan doesn't like, Al probably defers to Dan a little bit.
To get to Adams.
Of course, yeah.
But he's never liked Hawkeye, because Hawkeye was a smartass. An untalented smartass.
Yeah, that's true.
So he doesn't like him because there's no use for him, and he's probably going to mess shit up.
And he very much likes Adams, and has a lot of faith in Adams. So for Adams to spend time looking for piece of shit Hawkeye, that's less time that he could be spending with Al and doing stuff for Al. It's been, like, very important stuff for Al too, like serving as her second and being a potential spy and a potential double agent. That's a little more important in the work than going to find Hawkeye, who may or may not want to be found in the first place.
If I'm out fucking Indians, leave me alone.
Exactly. I think everyone said that at one time or another in their life. was that your last?
I believe that was the motto for Brian's wedding.
Yeah, it was a really long hashtag.
Which were not invented back then.
Right.
Whatever. Yeah, here or there. Do you got any more plot notes you want to bring up, Brian, before
I have unsourced quotes that we'll have to figure out who said them.
I don't think that'll be a problem. How about a scene of the week? You got one of those?
Nope.
Shane?
I'm going to go with talking up high like this while you talk low. And I will continue to talk.
I'm talking like this. I can't hear you.
There's so many great comic duos in Deadwood.
What? I don't know what the fuck was going on there.
Neither do I. Blaz and I was trying to explain something about telegrams.
And he failed miserably, but
wait, yeah,
it's a funny scene.
I thought you can send two telegraphs at once depending on the pitch of your voice.
Is that
your tone.
What's going on?
Yeah, that's it. I assume so. That seemed pretty straightforward to me.
Maybe
I don't think it has anything to
vibration.
Do with voices,
it's
but
vibration.
Yeah, like the amplitude of the sound wave, perhaps.
There we go. All
right. Right.
All right.
Okay.
The three of us together.
I don't understand what talking high and low was supposed to communicate.
I think it's a lack of English, so he couldn't really understand.
No, I thought the high and low was that you could send a high one.
Russians.
You could send a high one and a low one at the same time if you talked in two different tones.
That sounds right.
I don't know. It was a great scene.
Yeah, and Merrick just gives up after a certain point.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, Merrick was going to be my other. I have a second one I was just going to talk about.
Sure.
Langrish just completely hitting on Merrick, and Merrick completely oblivious to it. It's just.
He's being charmed. He knows he's being charmed so well, he knows he's being made fun of, but doesn't care.
Yeah. It's great. It's great.
Langrish, he's a charmer. Welcome to Deadwood. My scene of the week is Hurst debriefing with Tolliver about his day where he almost murdered Bullock and raped Alma. His mind is so interesting. The way he frames things, the way he treats those framings as completely natural. Like it's not that killing Bullock and raping Alma would have been bad for them. It would have been bad for Hurst and his long-term interests, even while it would have satisfied his short-term interests. It's just so unknowable and recognizable at the same time. If you're missing key parts of your personality and your life as a human, it's very recognizable as a villain, and just the way he's saying it, cloaked in shadow, reclining with a drink. He may as well just like put a cat in his chair and have that chair spin around in a circle. It's just a full villain turn. And the dialogue is fantastic and McRaney is fantastic. He's an interesting guy, Hurst, as despicable as he is. Deadwood of the Bible, Brian?
Nope.
All right.
I thought we talked about this.
I wanted to get it out there. I wanted to make your failure known to our thousands of fans who are anticipating another game of Deadwood of the Bible.
Oh, man. Maybe I'll do two next week if I can remember my church bulletin in my pocket.
Who's having a potluck? The Gem or the local church? our character focus this week is Steve the Drunk Fields. We've talked Steve out. It was really hard to like pick a character out. We've got four episodes left of podcast episodes. We've got eight episodes of Deadwood left. And like, there's a good fit for each of those episodes going forward. I had to really stretch to come up with Steve here. And he isn't even in the third episode. I just want to talk about him as like a textbook racist. There's just nothing Hosteller can do to get Steve on his side outside of approaching him on his... He can't approach Steve as a person. He has to approach him as a groveler. Like, he has the exact same problem as Hurst, in that he wants people to... the only people he wants to be around are, in Hurst's words, N-words, and whites who obey him like dogs. Steve wants exactly that, but has none of the power and the means and the grotesque dignity even that Hurst does.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd agree with that characterization, because I think Steve is just full of self-loathing. He recognizes that he's just a piece of shit. So he's trying to bring down all the other, everyone else around him and say, like, well, I'm not the biggest piece of shit here because black people are inferior for, you know, whatever reason, and start blaming black people. His rage goes outward instead of inward. Like, Hurst doesn't have that. Hurst is, you know.
In the strict sense of, like, as far as my comparison, just, like, he wants people to kowtow to him, but for completely different reasons. You're absolutely right.
I don't know if he wants people to kowtow to him at all. Like, does he want some credit for what he's done? Maybe, I guess, but...
Hosteller gives him that credit and it does nothing.
Right, exactly. He's just self-loathing and just complaining. He's just a fucking complainer. Like, he's just... This is why he's where he's at in life, because he's a fucking self-loathing complainer.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And that's like... I don't know. Like, Selma, that movie, had to paraphrase MLK's speeches, but the final speech in Selma is about racism is for... Like, the reason poor people are racist is because tend to be more racist or more outwardly racist is just because they need someone beneath them. And if they don't, then they just have nothing. And yeah, Steve is very much one of those, in addition to all of his self-loathing, as you correctly diagnosed there. Just taking it so far with Hosteller. and then Hosteller responding and Steve about ready to jump up and attack him for responding. We talked about, like, the bravery of the Cornishmen, the Cornish organizers, just Hosteller being there in a completely unbound place. It's becoming more bound. But when people like Steve are at the farthest end of the continuum, sure, but the vast, vast majority of people there have some variety, surely, of Steve's views, and
right.
Just how quickly things can turn for Hosteller. That he would call everybody in the number 10, including the sheriff, a motherfucker, is just, that's just him at the end. That's him at the end of his rope. I'm trying to do right here, and I can't get credit for it. Not even credit. I can't just get basic human respect out of Steve the drunk.
That's a tough scene, too.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. When Hosteller, like, turns his back to Steve, just against a torrent of invective, and just really grabbing onto his mouth, trying to keep his rage inside of him and failing. That's just like that outburst is years incoming, it seems.
Brian, any thoughts on this?
I have a quote from Alma.
Okay.
She says, "What is Steve the drunk surname?"
And it just happens to be the same surname as the general's.
Great.
What could that be about?
That's a good touch.
Yeah. I'm sure that's not an accident. What if there's nothing else to say about Steve, and we've talked about him earlier, he doesn't necessarily deserve the character focus this week. But I was reaching. Anything else on Steve?
Not that hasn't already been said.
Fantastic. Quotes for this week. Brian, what's your first unclaimed?
Well, I just used one of them. But my first one is, goes through men like Sherman to the sea.
That's Al to Langrish describing Alma in episode 3.
I think... Sure.
I'm going to put an addendum onto yours, and then his description of Bullock as an insane fucking person.
I'm going to say the two of us living in Atlanta, I think this is a pointed quote.
Oh, no, I feel fine with it.
Just, I don't know. I feel attacked, even though I'm not a Southerner.
Yeah.
I don't think
the city's probably better than it was.
Except for the straightness of those roads.
Sure. Yeah, yeah,
they should have pulled a Chicago when they burnt that place down. And anyway.
I've seen seven lane intersections or seven road intersections.
Yeah, cool. I think Sherman's March to the Sea might be one of the few Civil War things I remember because it's often quoted in some way or the other. And so
that's
think that's
big
good.
Deal. That's a great quote. One of my quotes.
I'm going to stick with Civil War humor here.
Oh, please.
I saw someone the other day.
Postpone for that.
What was it? The Confederate flag is the world's most popular, or is the United States' most popular participation trophy.
That stupid flag.
My first quote this week, Langreisch again to Al. Al feeling sorry for himself, and Langreisch looking out over the camp and saying, "A thing of this order you'd as soon not see ruined or in cinders." And of course, Al used to talk in the first season about burning the whole camp down just to spite people. Those days, like so many others in Deadwood, are long gone, and Al is just as much a part of the town now as the school children, and that's going to hopefully continue to last. Shane, quote.
Is that your goddamn idea of quick, Charlie?
The Seth Bullock Comedy Hour, just killing it. And I'll add an addendum to that, too, when he's in the gym and we get some rapid-fire editing between Bullock and Al, and Bullock responding to Al, "You gonna fuck with me?"
That was great.
Just raising an eyebrow. It's just a fantastic read. Tim Oliphant, as said, funny guy. And they're letting him loosen up a little bit in this season. Brian, your next quote.
Last one here. I have this one is, "Morning, best time of day to go fuck yourself."
That would be Dan to Captain Turner in episode 4, of course.
Made me chuckle.
Shane?
Perhaps you consider fucking yourself. All right, Joni Stubbs.
Joni Stubbs, just awesome. A little win for her as she backs her way into a deal with Langreisch, even after telling him to go fuck himself earlier. I've got an EB quote. I'm not even going to try to do an EB voice. After being called out on one of his quotes, he responds, not having known the author, he says, "I have a digest from which I memorize," suppressing the author's names. Why he would add that second part, in which he just blatantly admits to plagiarizing the great authors of the 19th and probably 18th and so on and so forth century, that's very EB. I'm a piece of shit, and I don't care who knows it.
That's pretty great.
Shane, any more?
Al talking about amateur night. Guy farted, seemed near an hour. Johnny Burns, doesn't seem like an amateur to me. It's great.
Big win for Johnny Burns with a joke that lands. You even see your reaction out of Al on that one. My last quote, last line of episode 4. Al's been complaining about being held down, realizes that he does that to Dolly when she is servicing him, and she says she doesn't mind. And Al says, "Well, bless you for a fucking fibber." Cut to black. It's a real beautiful moment as he recognizes some empathy.
It was a good one. I actually almost picked that one too. I saw you had it, but there's so many good ones. I just can't add one more.
Yeah, sure.
When will I have the courage to search that woman's room? EB's great.
Terrifying backstory. I think EB was the inspiration for American Horror Story 5th season when it was in a hotel. Just barging into people's rooms and seeing what's going on. Our final segment of the night, Cruel Masquerade. Well, we're going to do a scene from Full Faith and Credit. Brian is going to be Hurst. I'm Cy, and Shane's Al. And Brian, you can start us off whenever you're ready.
I didn't prepare for this in any way.
Okay.
Just a quick FYI. All right, here we go. My back's in frank rebellion. Gentlemen, will you mind if I keep to this angles?
Hang upside down from the ceiling for all of me.
It may come to that, Mr. Swearingen. I will take your silence for assent. We pass another milestone. Bank of Deadwood opens its doors. Is not Miss Ellsworth a dynamo?
Let's find one and send it to her.
What's the occasion? I have my physician to see.
How are you indisposed, Mr. Swearingen?
Sick at the stomach.
Would you wish to leave now? Mr. Tolliver can report our conversation.
Tough it out, Al. Like me, that guts is more outside his pants than in.
The occasion?
The camp comes to such an hour, I'd have us reach a new understanding.
The hour meaning elections.
I am given pause by the quality of certain of the likely victors, but I have come to believe as well that my temperament ill suits me for environments such as this one must become, and other opportunities presenting themselves elsewhere. I may best serve my own interests here by standing at some remove.
Are you leaving? Can you say it straight out before I have a fucking birthday?
I will be coming and going. Is that straight out enough?
Well, what's the task you give us? And what's our fucking piece for doing them?
Al.
Shut up.
To not let become over-onerous my interest encounter with the camp's retrogressive elements.
Meaning what, you phony bastard? Who do we kill? What's our pay?
It ain't fair to make it that simple, Al.
Fuck you. He took the pick to me simple enough.
We will get to numbers quickly once we've agreed in principle.
Numbers are the only principle I believe in, and naming what the numbers by. When you and him come to him, tell fucking Adams he'll bring you my reply later. Him and me, we've had our last word.
Insane. Job, guys. Brian, felt your way through that one with no preparation even. Well done.
I didn't do any either. I was just like trying to like what are the patterns.
The language, man, it's tough.
I think with Langrish in town especially, it's gotten a little more circuitous than it has been in previous scenes. I don't say that's negative. It's just an observation. But yeah, senses folding back on themselves.
Hearst, you can talk a little slower, I feel like. It's a little more deliberate.
Sure.
Well, they're all deliberate. It's not like we can talk a little slower. Like, whereas Al's a little more rhythmic, and Sai has that kind of up and down. Nature to it, and where he just like huddles through like three words at once.
And Hearst is also like dealing with back pain in that scene. So, in the future, Brian.
Yeah, maybe we'll just redo it next time I throw my back out. That's a great idea.
Fantastic. Yeah. You'll have plenty of time for podcasting then, I would imagine.
That's true.
All right, we'll hold you to it. That'll do us for this episode of the Mediocre Movie Cast. Check us out on the internet at mediocremovie.club. Like us on Facebook, Mediocre Movie Club. Twitter, Mediocre Movie Call. 5-star reviews on on iTunes, always appreciated. Maybe we'll check that out again and see if we've got another one.
I'm on my way. I'm on my way if you can stall.
This week on the Mediocre Movie Club, we're talking about Pee-wee's Big Holiday. Getting off to a pretty slow start on that one. A strange pick from our strangest member. And we say that with love, of course.
Has anyone written a follow-up?
I wrote a 2-paragraph review of it, which might go down as my shortest review ever. Not a lot there.
I'm excited for it. I just haven't had the time since I was dying all week of sickness.
No one believes you, Shane.
I do. I was real sick in August, too. It's crazy.
We'll be talking about Spike Lee's School Days, which is, Brian, a musical.
Oh.
Set at a black college in the 80s, I want to say. It's his third or fourth film. I don't know. Spike Lee's. Which is our second Spike Lee movie of season 3, strange enough. That review will go up next week. I just recently wrote a side piece for The Good Dinosaur. Pretty freaking good movie. Surprisingly good. I had low expectations going in, but it worked on me.
I might need to respond to you on that one.
Fair enough.
Seen it, Shane? Did you guys cuddle and watch it together?
14 times on a vacation weekend with a 4-year-old.
All right, that's a lot. With a 4-year-old?
Yeah.
Is that a different kid?
Not mine, yes.
Oh, God. Well, yeah, that's even worse.
Yeah.
I would imagine parents have general empathy for their kids and essentially no empathy for other kids because they've got all that empathy for their own.
You have the empathy for the parents of the other kids.
Reasonable.
Just like, I understand.
reasonable. We'll be back next week with another movie podcast. Maybe.
Maybe we'll be back. We might just skip these
maybe.
Two.
We might. We'll certainly be back with another episode of to discuss Deadwood. The next episode. Hoo boy. The next episode's a good one. Brian, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but if you could like sit on it for a little bit until we're closer to recording so you can get a truer reaction. I know it's right, a lot to ask.
Well, no, we get playing town this weekend, cross country meet. You just let me know. Let me know okay. when I need to watch it and okay. then I'll knock them out in a night.
And we, on Tuesday, we'll be recording an episode about the first half of the Netflix series Stranger Things with some rarely heard from MMC members, as well as superfan Megan. So that'll be something to look forward to. That's going to be a good episode. I've been watching that show. Pretty interesting, but there's still certainly plenty of stuff to disagree on. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
It's been a pleasure.
Have a good night.